Yeah, you can go ahead and sit down, Franz. I guess it falls to me to get us underway. So I'm going to suggest that we take a moment for prayer. Welcome you here. Most of you, I suppose, were here this morning and got installment one, and you've returned, and that's a good thing. And so we'll look forward to hearing what Professor Harry has for us as we continue on. Let us pray. God of peace, we are your people gathered wishing to hear and learn and take in what your Spirit has to say to us through one of your servants. And we pray for your blessing and your guidance on our conversation and our learning. In Jesus' name, amen. So, I don't suppose we need another, but you've got quite an aura there, Harry. Yeah. So, that has a good foreboding, I think. Professor Harry Huebner from CMU to present to us.
Get feedback from the speaker up there? Okay. All right. Well, good afternoon. It makes a difference between Sunday morning worship and then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. When I think of trying to do this in Charleswood, it would be very difficult. The only way we would keep people is if we offered them all food, and then still some people would eat and leave. But nice to see you all here. It's good to be back. Okay. You see the slide up above. Pacifism, can we still believe or live it? And this particular portable, we have these portable packets at CMU, and this particular one was designed for a sermon plus three other sort of lectures or meetings, and we have two here in this context, which is fine, one today and one tomorrow evening. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the outline as it is there, but I'm going to not follow it that carefully. I'm simply going to keep going, and I'll have to be a little briefer than I sometimes am with each of these sessions in order to get through. But I do think it's important for us to get to the last session, Living Peaceably in a Violent World. This isn't going to follow in quite the neat sequence that I'm suggesting in this one, but we'll just keep going. It's always a question of where to begin on this topic, and why pacifism? Why do I think it's important to talk about this? And there are several reasons I can give for that. I mean, my whole life in teaching has been about, well, peacemaking or Christian ethics, which in my way of thinking has a lot to do with trying to find ways of living life peaceably. In various different contexts, I mean, I've been teaching at a Christian college, university for most of my life, but I've also had other experiences and other teaching opportunities, and in part it's been the other teaching opportunities that have convinced me most of the importance of the message of peace and peacemaking. You saw a little bit about that in the sermon this morning. Here locally, there used to be a course at the University of Manitoba called Philosophy of War and Peace, taught by a former professor of mine, Professor Martin Gerwin, who was a Christian one of the very few in the philosophy department. But he didn't really refer to that much in this class. But it wasn't offered when I was a student there. But he had a lecture, a slot, on pacifism. And he would always call me and say, you know, Harry, you're the only pacifist I know. So could you come and give the lecture? And so I would give the lecture in a philosophy class. And of course, being in a secular university philosophy class, that, and particularly with a good number of military people in the class, it was always a very rich experience. I was never run out of the room, but in fact, I was always amazed at the amount of interest there was by the military people in finding alternative ways, alternative to war ways of resolving disputes, of resolving tensions. And so that was one context. But then in the early 80s, I was invited to live and work in out of Jerusalem in the Middle East, working with the Israel-Palestine conflict. And MCC gave me a very open ticket, basically saying, do what you can to represent the peace voice of MCC in this region. And that very quickly became complicated because I had to get a job description approved by the Israeli military in order for me to work there, primarily with the Palestinians, but in the West Bank and Gaza. Because it was under occupation, the military had to approve my job description in order for me to get a permit to stay there. It wasn't quite a work visa, but it was a permit to stay there. And so I was very honest about what I would do. And one of the things that I said I would do is promote nonviolent peacemaking within the region, but particularly with Palestinians. And I remember when he looked at this and he called me in and said, we have to talk about this. So I was new to the scene. We talked about this, and he said, well, there's no way we're going to let you do this. And my initial response was puzzlement. Like, why wouldn't it be in the Israeli military interest for me to try to help Palestinians find nonviolent ways of going about their protests or whatever it might be? And then he said very sternly to me, like, we're not dumb. We know that as long as the... Now this was the head military commander of the occupied territories, West Bank and Gaza. He was the boss. And he says, you know, if the Palestinians ever decided as a group to be completely nonviolent, we lose. Which is very puzzling to me. Like, he says, as long as they are violent, there's no problem. We have a way better military than they ever could have. We will win. But if we have to fight them on nonviolent sort of moral integrity grounds, we lose. You know, like, I'll never forget that. I went home and says, like, this can't be real. But he says I had to take it out of my job description, which I did. But truth be told, and he never really found out, I still promoted nonviolence in the region. I mean, that's who I am. That's what I do. And we did it. And I did get into trouble, of course, but this is not about that. We might want to tell some stories about that. I'm not sure yet. But then, of course, in the last while, I've been involved in Iran. Some of you heard me say this morning. And that's sort of by happenstance. I got involved in a dialogue between Iranians and Christians, or Mennonites, some 15 years ago. And that sort of developed into teaching there in their universities and seminaries. And what is very fascinating to me there is that everything in that country is religious. There's no secular there, which is very, like, it's like, it's an experience to be there. And it's like any public university, private university, seminary, whatever, it's religious. The Quran is always one of the main texts, and the religious professors, philosophers, theologians are everywhere. And so it was fascinating to me to sort of be, which is very different than teaching in a philosophy department at the University of Manitoba. I mean, teaching a course there. I mean, that's like, why are you talking religion here? This is not allowed here. You know, that's there. But I mean, in Iran, that's very different, and it's fascinating to me. And they want me to give them the Christian voice. That's their interest. Like, what do the Christians have to offer? What do Mennonites have to offer by way of Christian ethics? And I've, I don't know, some of you may have seen this big book that I wrote as a kind of a textbook for Christian ethics. And they have this. In fact, most of it's been translated into Farsi there by now because they're interested in understanding what Christians think. And what they have done is they have responded by saying this message that, and they say not all Christians speak the same way, but you Mennonites, you're constantly harping on this peace thing. Like, peace is somehow so intricately connected to your faith. And the more they think about that, the more they say, you know, this makes some sense. I mean, for one thing, they believe very deeply in the teachings of Jesus. The Muslims do there. Because Jesus is an important prophet, and he had a lot of things right. And so when you link this to what Jesus teaches, they listen. Sometimes more than Christians do when I talk to them about what Jesus said. But I find this so fascinating. And to the extent that they are now beginning, and I'm not, it's not that I'm taking credit for this, there are other people who have been there, that they're now beginning to have peace studies programs in their colleges and universities. One of the seminaries in Qom has made peace theology a requirement for all their students as a standard course. You can't graduate without taking two units of peace theology, one a Muslim and the other a Christian. And that's one of the reasons I go there, because I get to teach the Christian part of that requirement, which is fascinating. And now, just now, in April, they're beginning a peace and conflict resolution studies center at the Tehran University. That's a bit different. This is the capital city. It's kind of the main university of the country. And again, the person who is heading that has said to me personally, you Mennonites have taught us that we should really pay more attention to peace, which is fascinating to me how this thing just goes. And it's inspired me to be more and more preoccupied with giving voice to Christian peacemaking, which in our tradition has been called pacifism, although pacifism can be defined in many different ways, which I'm not going to try to do. But that's by way of background and why I think it's worth talking about more. Now, when you talk to an Anabaptist Mennonite community, a Mennonite church, you speak differently than when you talk to, what, a philosophy department or some other particular context. Like, where do you begin? And so what I'm going to do here this afternoon is begin with the Anabaptist Mennonite peace legacy. Like, and this is not to say that there weren't pacifists before the Anabaptists. I actually really dislike the way of reading church history that starts with Jesus and picks it up with the Radical Reformation and then we today. I don't like doing that at all. But, you know, we only have so many hours of time here. And so I'm going to begin with the Anabaptist Mennonite peace legacy, like what have we been left with and how did that happen and who has said what, and then move to what I call a more in-depth view of peace theology and practice, and then hopefully get to living peaceably in a violent society. And we'll do that between now and tomorrow sometime. We'll try to get through that. So if we can go to the next slide, and I'm assuming that when I say that, it automatically happens behind me. Does it? Yes. Good. I'm not going to always turn around. So the Anabaptist Mennonite peace legacy, the early Anabaptist Mennonite confessions and what it is that they say there. And I have to be very, very skimpy and brief here. I mean, lots of things could be said here. But if you take the 1527 famous Schleitheim Confession, for example, you see lots of language there that talks about this new confession, this new interpretation of faith that people like Michael Sattler and others were trying to articulate, is all about separating ourselves from the evil world. I mean, you know the importance of doing that by practicing adult baptism. You have to make a decision to follow Christ and to follow Christ daily. And that, like, that requires a kind of a view of discipleship and a view of the community as a body of committed believers. And how is that defined? Well, through a conscientious separation from evil, from sin. Now, this doesn't mean that you're no longer part of the world in the sense that you give up your jobs that you might have wherever it might be. You may be a city or a village employee, but there are certain kinds of things you can no longer do when you're asked to do them. Why? Because what's normative here is not what the world or even the mainline churches tell you to do, but our interpretation of what it means to separate yourself from this evil world and be dedicating yourself to being a disciple of Jesus Christ. That's what's normative. And so you have someone like Conrad Grebel who says that the gospel and its adherents are not to be protected by the sword, nor are they to protect themselves in that way. Now, you know, I should have maybe made a slide of this, but I didn't. But there's like this notion of the world. Can you imagine, like, if you want to diagram this, I've done this in other places, if you have a sort of the kingdom of God on top and the kingdom of the world or kingdom of evil down here, and then there's sort of a coil where God is working at redeeming the world, right? Always. I mean, this is the work of God. This is how it's understood. And there's this, and the world is not always at the same place with respect to that. Sometimes it gets pulled down, it gets dragged down by sin, it gets dragged down by evil. But there's this elastic kind of relationship. But then the question is, how do we, the Anabaptists, how do we understand ourselves in this relationship? Like, how do we get involved in pulling up the spring, right? Like in putting tension going upward. How are we involved in that? And you see, they were quite aware of what Luther had said. I mean, Luther has said, look, I mean, there are sort of two two parts to this kingdom. There's the secular part, and then there's the church part. And we as Christians are in both of those. And in the church part, it's all kinds of things. There you preach. That's the revealed part of God through Jesus Christ. Jesus is normative there, and it's revealed through God how it is that we ought to live. On the other side of this, it's not that that's not under God's jurisdiction. It is under God's jurisdiction. But there the secular authorities have the say, right? And what governments say, you must do. That also can be under God. It's the created order, and this is the revealed order. You understand that distinction? Or you don't always see God that clearly on the created order. God is hidden, that was Luther's language, and revealed on the other side. But for Luther, we as Christian individuals operate in both. And so when the state calls us to use arms, we use arms. Why? Because they have the authority under God to make that, to do that. It's not that that's wrong. Now, that's not what Jesus reveals or Christ reveals on the other side. But as Christian individuals, we're in both. Now, the Anabaptists rejected that. I mean, we know that. They said, we cannot. What's normative, ultimately, is on the revealed side. And that's how we must live. They would not say that therefore what the secular authorities were doing was wrong. It's just not what we can do. Right? I mean, is this all very familiar to you? Or it's just sort of familiar? Anyway, this is review then. but that's sort of the way God started. Now, so how then is the church? How does it affect the spring, you know? How are we pulling upward on bringing about the kingdom of God? Okay? Like that's the question here. Because for Luther, it was when we operated on both sides. When the governing authorities told us to do this, we're helping God accomplish God's purposes. That even involves wars. Involves capital punishment. It involves, you know, punishment of sin. For the Anabaptists, no. How is sin dealt with? Forgiveness and redemption. Never by, you know, destroying the sinner. And so there were these two different things. Again, in the mainline, at least Lutheran view, individuals were both, were the Anabaptists not. Now, there was a kind of a porous connection. I mean, it's not that, I mean, sure there was separation from evil, but not categorical in that you had nothing to do with it. You lived in the world. And yet, what's normative is this other side. And how then did the Anabaptists see their relevance as witnesses? You know what another word for witness? Martyr. The word martyr literally means witness. Because you're giving expression to your faith in God when you are martyred. And of course, the early Anabaptists experienced that. But as a martyr or as a witness, you gave expression to what God desired. And after all, this is God's business. God's bringing about the peaceful world. We have to be careful about how we understand our own involvement in that, they would say. We don't know why there are wars and why God has empowered government agencies to declare wars. We don't know why that is. We just know that that's, if we participate in that, we lose the witness. And so we can't. We have to stand there as witnesses. Now, there are, of course, other voices within the Anabaptist tradition. Not all Anabaptists believe that. And I quote here in 1535, Bernard Rotman. because there were some people who said, look, this witness thing, that's not very effective. We're never going to get the kingdom established that way. We have to get more actively involved in making the world a better place. That was very much a debate there, at least at the beginning. That did not characterize any mainline Anabaptist movement. But there was that voice present. Let me read what Rothman says. He states that we and all true Christians in this time not only be allowed to turn away the power of the ungodly with the sword. It's not just a permissive thing, like a reluctantly permissive thing. No. It's much bigger than that. Even more, he says, that the sword be put into the hands of the people to avenge all that is unjust and evil in the whole world. The time is at hand. We need to take up arms, and we need to bring about the new Jerusalem, the new kingdom. Because it's never going to happen if we just stand by and watch. So, there was that voice. I call that the Mennonite Jihad voice. And this is actually not my language. It's there's a French philosopher, a contemporary philosopher, by the name of Michel Foucault, who lived in Iran for during the revolution time, and he was trying to find correlations in the Christian world to the jihad notion of radical Islam. And where did he find it? He says with the early Anabaptists and the revolutionaries there. Why? Because, I don't want to say that this was a mainline Anabaptist movement. It wasn't. It never made it. But there is that voice. That's all I'm trying to say here. There is that voice of, we need to take up arms to bring it about. Because it's not going to happen if we just stand by. Now, of course, the Anabaptists didn't think we were just standing by. They thought they were giving voice to the power of God, which in a sense is not idly standing by. I mean, God's power normally is greater than ours. So it's not just that, but there is this counter voice. So it has to do with this struggle with how do we bring about, how do we struggle? I mean, that's another word for jihad, like it's a struggle. How do we struggle for peace and justice in the world today? As witnesses, whatever all that entails, or do we get right into the fray and make whatever compromises we need to in order to try to advance things? That's that other approach. And that is not a new debate. That's an old one, except that you don't hear very much of that within the early Anabaptist tradition. Now, let's fast forward. There's lots of stuff here that's in between, but let's go to the next slide and look at how this gets picked up, sort of in the more contemporary Mennonite Anabaptist sort of theological tradition. H.S. Bender, writing during the Second World War, church historian, and he laments that we need to find ways of picking up the power of our tradition. The Anabaptist tradition, he believes, has a lot of power, and we are losing it. And so he may, in fact, be emboldened by, let's recall some other things that were going on. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote his Cost of Discipleship. Is that a book that you've heard of before? He wrote, I think that came out in 1937, in which Bonhoeffer, who who is he tried to be a pacifist. There's a question about whether he was or not. That's an open debate, particularly because he was involved in the resistance movement to the point where he plotted some violence in order to get rid of Hitler. But in 37, he excuse me, he was very much convinced that I have a little thing here that's supposed to help me with my voice, but that's gone, so we'll deal with it. He was very much convinced that the central teaching of Jesus is that his followers be invited to be namely followers or disciples. Not just the early disciples. What does it mean to be a disciple? It means that you open yourself up to the teaching and to the life of the master. That's what it means to be a disciple. I'm not going to go into this, but I remember when I lived in Jerusalem, I got very interested in the yeshiva, the Jewish teaching seminary, and some of the Orthodox yeshiva fostered this notion of discipleship. Like you, when you become a student in those seminaries, you don't just become a student of the word. You become a disciple of someone who has mastered the word. And you follow him around. And you do what he does. And I can use he quite liberally here because that's what they had, was he's. That's literal. Like, you just follow them around and you in everything, whether it's familial relationships or how you teach or how you speak or whatever it might be. Bonhoeffer was convinced that the Christian life had to do with following Jesus. What are some of the other options? Another option would be, well, Jesus teaches us how to love one another, right? Okay, well, we all know what loving one another means, so let's just try to love one another. No. That's not discipleship. That's abstracting a concept and then putting it in your head and then trying to figure out what to do. Disciples mean doing as the master does. And one of the things that the master does, in the case of Jesus, of course, he gives his life up for those who have other ideas about your life. So is willing to sacrifice his life. And Bonhoeffer believed that. Now, it might be that people like Bender were... I mean, this is, in a sense, the first... Nah, it's not the first, but a very important kind of a mainline voice. Now, Bonhoeffer was not really mainline, but he was a German. He was a German theologian, an excellent theologian. He had some status. He'd been in the U.S., and he was now, in a sense, taking part of this theme of the Anabaptists and making it popular. Oh, I see. And I suspect that might have had something to do. In fact, I've heard Bender say that very thing, that it emboldened him to write this article in 44. Like, that's what, 7 years later. And here's what he says, just a snapshot. The Anabaptist vision included three major points of emphasis. First, a new conception of the essence of Christianity as discipleship. It's such a strange sentence, isn't it? Like, the new understanding? Well, it's new in relation to the way the Christian churches in the world were understanding things. It wasn't that discipleship wasn't the key thing. It was somehow Christ's importance to us was as a savior. And it's not that he was de-emphasizing that, but it was as a resource or as someone who gave some general advice, but not as a disciple. And so it's new in relation to the way it was understood at the time. Second, a new concept of the church as a brotherhood, peoplehood, That is, the church isn't just, you know, a collection of people who have been baptized or baptized as infants. You know, when you're baptized as an infant, you don't have much say as to whether you want to follow Jesus. You're just baptized, and then you're in the church. And so you have a church that exists of all kinds of people, many of whom have not made the decision to follow Jesus. So you have following Jesus, discipleship, and that means a new concept of the church. And third, a new ethic of love and non-resistance. Okay? So those three things, he says, characterize, at least for us, how it is that he suggested we ought to pick up the Anabaptist's vision and appropriate it unto ourselves. And that really was very interesting because of what it did to the content, at least the American, not only American, view of the church and the meaning of pacifism. His cohort, a guy of Hirschberger, writes in he thinks very much in line with this when he, but what he does is he contrasts this notion of non-resistance with non-violent resistance. And he says, look, what Jesus is all about is non-resistance, not non-violent resistance. You don't resist, you let it happen to you. Whatever evil comes to you, you let it happen. Because, why? Because God is in charge, and even if it causes you death, that's not failure. It might be failure to the world, but it's not failure in the kingdom. Okay? And so you don't resist. You let it happen. And he contrasts that with Gandhi. Gandhi didn't learn enough from Jesus, according to Hirschberger. He was still too Hindu. And he was emphasizing a way of resisting power, but doing it nonviolently. That might be good, but not. And it's fascinating that in this way, what Hirschberger does is partners, in terms of theological understanding of things, with a contemporary Christian ethicist by the name of Reinhold Niebuhr. He also had a brother called Richard Niebuhr, and they were both writing about the same kinds of things, who were arguing that Jesus did not talk about nonviolent resistance. He talked about non-resistance. And here, Hirschberger said, exactly, yeah, that's right. We can be with people like Niebuhr, except that Niebuhr was not a pacifist, and Hirschberger was a pacifist. And yet, Hirschberger's pacifism was non-resistance because he believed in Jesus. Niebuhr says Jesus never intended to be followed. He was about something else. So he could talk about non-resistance, but non-resistance is useless for the world. So if we want to be relevant to the world and do sort of Christian ethics, we have to reject what Jesus taught about non-resistance. And we have to, like, if you want to go to non-violent resistance, that's fine, but then that's got nothing to do with Christianity. Are you following me on this? You look a bit like, whoops, really? That was an interesting turn. Okay, you got it? Good. So now you have someone like Hirschberger who says, no one has done a better job or has done better than Reinhold Niebuhr in showing the sharp distinction between non-violence and New Testament pacifism. So, there you go. Now you've got this. In a sense, the whole argument is now set up, particularly in the North American theological Mennonite community. And a lot of people start weighing in on this in terms of trying to debate how we should understand pacifism and how we should understand what Jesus teaches. is this distinction. Maybe we should just... Time is going rather quickly here. Maybe we should just stop briefly on... And I'm not finished talking yet. even though my voice is starting to give up. briefly on this question of non-resistance and non-violent resistance. Is that something you want to talk about in terms of what Jesus teaches? What do you think? Do not resist evil. Sounds. Yeah. Someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also.
I believe it's very hard to believe what Jesus did because he's the only one that did it. I think with our best effort, we won't get to that point.
Okay.
That's what we did by faith. But I do believe that he means exactly what he said because he did exactly what he said. And in doing that, okay. He showed us the way for us to grab it, at least for me to grab it, is, in my view, impossible without his help.
Okay. Did... some of you may have heard of the American theologian by the name of Walter Wink. Is that a name to any of you? No. Some of you who have studied theology will have probably heard of him. Walter Wink asks the question of what's going on when Jesus makes all these radical statements. Because people like Niebuhr said, you can't rule a world by turning the other cheek. I mean, there's far too much sin in this world. You have to deal with it. And so that's useless. Or do not resist evil. I mean, come on. Like, how can you possibly rule? How can you possibly apply that to the world? And so for Niebuhr argues that we need people like Mennonites. I mean, we like Mennonites who are strictly pacifists and non-resistant. We need people like that because they remind us of the ideal. But their ethic is completely useless for how you ought to live in the world. I mean, for that, you need something else. And so you got it there, but we have to be realistic, right? Like for Niebuhr was what we call a Christian realist. And pacifists and like the Mennonite view of pacifism, they were idealists and therefore useless. I mean, and that's why it's important. I mean, that's why Mennonites couldn't be in government, right? I mean, they can't get that together, and so you shouldn't be there. And that's why, you know, you should, you know, try to get church jobs. But if you have to, okay, be farmers, you know, do those kinds of things, and maybe. But anything that gets you involved. In like maybe the helping professions, but see that's going on. Certainly not lawyers. Like yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. Can't be there. And politicians. Oh heavens! Are any politicians here? Like either provincial or okay. I want to know whose toes I'm stepping on because that's always fun. So okay, got a lawyer. I mean, medical, okay, you're doing something good, right? I mean, that's a bit different. So you can be doctors and nurses, that's fine. But, you know, not the other thing. Now, and that's because there's this very sharp sharp distinction. But, you know, it's really, like, that gets wrestled with. But what Wink does is he says, think of this little passage, and I could go into much more of detail here, but I won't. On turning the other cheek. Like the passage says, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to that person the other one also. Now, Marv, come here. Get up. You and I are friends, I hope. But like,
Okay. Fairly recent.
Yeah, fairly recent, but it might end about rather quickly. But where's your right cheek?
Well, it would be this one.
That would be that one there. Now, if I were to strike you on your right cheek, how would I do that? I mean, we're right-handed, a right-handed society. And so how would I do that? Like I'd go like that, right? Like that. Well, and which, and then, the expression is, if someone gives you this backhanded slap, turn to him the other one, which, of course, would be an open-handed slap, right? Okay, that's it all. Now, Wink plays around with that, and I'm not suggesting here that this is, like Jesus had all this in mind when he said these kinds of things, but nevertheless, I remember when I was living in Jerusalem, I saw this repeatedly, and I could never quite figure out what was going on, but it'd be two guys who would meet on a sidewalk, friends, and they'd meet each other like this, and they'd come up to each other close until they were right close to each other, and then they'd take their hands and they'd slap each other on the cheek like this. That was a greeting of friendship. Now, I can never figure this out. And I asked whether that was a relatively new way of greeting. No. This is way back in our tradition. And there's another New Testament scholar, actually, whose name is Kenneth Bailey. Some of you may have heard of him, too. Kenneth Bailey says that when he was in doubt as to, he taught in Beirut at the seminary in Beirut for many years. He says when he was in doubt on what a parable or something in the Bible meant, he would go to the most ancient Palestinian village he could find. And there he would read this parable to them and says, what does this mean? And they would tell him what that parable meant, because the tradition that they were following was still very much the same as the tradition in which Jesus was speaking. So I find that a fascinating kind of a hermeneutic. And Kenneth Bailey is a very fascinating person. He's written some interesting books. If you're interested in reading his interpretation of Prodigal Son and some others, they're online. Nowadays, you can just Google Kenneth Bailey and you got it. Now, if what people like Wink and others are suggesting, that this particular expression of turning the other cheek, if someone strikes you in the right, turn to that person the left also, could possibly be interpreted as, if someone gives you an insult, extend to that person the invitation of friendship. Now, is that non-resistance? Or is that a form of resistance, if in fact we go there? And again, it's a bit of a stretch, but I just put that out there for you to ponder. Now let's go to the next slide. I mean, in any case, I do think the point that I want to make here is that moving too far away from the microphone, I think, this distinction between non-resistance and non-violent resistance may not be as absolute as we think it is. So a lot of the things that Jesus was talking about may very well be a form of resistance. Not an ultimate form of resistance, so that he was willing to kill his persecutors in order to escape his own life, but nevertheless, certain forms of resistance so that he himself may not be led into temptations. Whatever. Let's leave that there. And let's go on. The next slide, please. Is this the one, the one complexification slide? Is that what it is? No, go back up. Yeah, complexification, right. In the last, several decades, there's particularly in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, there's been another whole look at these distinctions, and things become more and more messy. I mean, it's part of the thing that, you know, a lot of these categories begin very simply, but then turn out to be much less clear. I mean, there's the Niebuhr ethic of Jesus. The Niebuhrs say the ethic of Jesus is not possible in this world. I mean, Reinhold writes a book on why the Christian church is not pacifist, and basically he says, well, Jesus didn't teach pacifism. He taught non-resistance. The world can't live that way. The church understood that, and so therefore they could never accept it. They became realistic. And so if whatever it was that Jesus was teaching was not for now. It was for some other time. Maybe at the last time when evil would be defeated. But you cannot, in the presence of evil, live like Jesus taught. That was his point. That gets challenged in many ways. There are some people in our Mennonite tradition who get very much moved by that, particularly as the church world binary, that distinction, gets messed up. As more and more people became educated in the normal kind of things that we have in this world, like you become a banker, you become a university professor and teach in a secular university, you become doctors and lawyers and teachers and on and on. Well, we're no longer separated. What we are is in the world trying to make things better, in the world trying to make things more peaceful and more just. That doesn't mean that we're going about killing people. It's not that. But the notion of what it means to live a peaceful life gets somewhat changed, certainly not in this pristine separatist way. And so there is, people like Burkholder and Kaufman, they say a partial yes to Niebuhr, but still a nevertheless no. They're still very much in favor of the peace tradition. And then you have people like John Howard Yoder and Paul Lederach who want to say a much more radical no to Niebuhr and say, look, Jesus is relevant for us now. Even the radical sayings of Jesus are relevant for us now. And that takes another whole form of debate, which I want to visit shortly. But there are other movements that deeply affect this. One is the liberation theology movement, where people who are oppressed are struggling and trying to overcome their oppression. They're up against structures that are deeply violent and keeping them in unjust situations. How do you respond? The liberation theologians, most liberation theologians will say, look, nobody can tell us to be nonviolent unless, first of all, the superstructures, the powers under which we have to live are violent. As long as they're violent, you can't tell us to be nonviolent. Okay? I mean, that makes some sense. I mean, you know, these things get really complicated. Who do you speak to nonviolence about? I know that when I lived in Jerusalem, we tried to bring in Gene Sharp. Gene Sharp, a name to people here? No. He's a Quaker of background, at least, taught at Harvard University in the political studies department there for many, many years, and actually he and I became personal friends. And so, but he talks about nonviolent direct action as a political strategy quite apart from any religious justification. It just works better. It works better in the sense that if people were trained how to resist nonviolently, there would be fewer deaths, whether that's confronting Hitler or any other kind of political context whatsoever. That's his general argument. And he's a very fascinating read. So if you haven't if you're interested in that, look up his books. Gene Sharp. Anyway, we wanted to, it's a long story, but we wanted to invite him to speak to people in the region of Israel and the occupied territories. And I was working with a committee there to try to do this, and they were all in favor of getting in contact with him. I phoned him, and he said, yeah, he'd love to come. And so then we, as a committee, some Jewish folks, some Palestinian folks, okay, Israeli folks, Palestinian folks, and he says, okay, now let's plan. Where would he speak first? Oh, that's a very difficult question to know how to answer. Because if he speaks to the Palestinians first, it sounds like they're the violent ones, right? And they need to be told to not be violent. So we can't speak there first. He has to first speak to the Israelis. Well, no. Israeli says, you're not speaking to us first because then we're the bad ones. Do you know that became, like, it sounds so petty, doesn't it? But do you know that we had to disinvite him? We couldn't resolve that question. So he says, I'm sorry, you can't come. We don't know where you're speaking first. And you can't just speak. You have to speak somewhere, someplace, some first or second. So, like who you speak the message of peace to becomes a deeply political kind of a thing. And that's one of the things that liberation theology puts onto the agenda. Like liberation, everybody's for liberation, but how do you bring it about? And, you know, do you just use strategic kind of best ways or what? Particularly when violence is used against you. And you'll see that with any liberation group. If you speak to them about using nonviolence, boy, you better be prepared for a pretty loud response. I've been there. That's you have to be very careful about that. And but that's a very important. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't pacifist liberation theologians. There are, but most of them don't go there. There's the feminist movement, which is part of this whole discussion as well. There's a new generation that speaks about the church. I mean, feminists will too. The church as a violent structure. Whoa. The Mennonite church as a violent structure. Okay. I mean, how's that? And then what do you do with that? I mean, if there's such a thing as a violent structure, I certainly believe there is, then what does being pacifist in relation to that even mean? And, of course, the powers, whether it's structural powers or any kinds of powers, any kind of system, technology, speed. I mean, there's a fair bit of literature out there that talks about one of the sources of violence in our society is speed, that we don't slow down and allow peace to happen. Why? Because it has to be resolved now, immediately. And peaceful options aren't always on the table for immediate resolution. Peacemaking takes time. Okay, let's go to the next slide. And I just want to introduce this, and then we'll open it up for discussion. This actually gets into the second session, and you'll see why. I tried very hard to speed this up, but okay, it doesn't speed so quickly. Speed is a bad thing. So, what I call a more in-depth view of peace theology, and what I want to do, I guess, next time, tomorrow evening, is pick this up and talk about, and here I want to rely on people like Yoder and Lederach, both Mennonite theologians, and I'm always reluctant nowadays to talk about Yoder, because I think most of you know some of the negative history there, where he was disciplined by the church for sexual abuse, and then it's always a question of one goes with that. It's a real dilemma for me because I learned so much from his writings. Would never think of him as a master whom you follow, but I just learned. I mean, he was deeply, deeply stimulating. His writings were deeply stimulating and shaped my own thinking about peacemaking so deeply. But I don't know what to do with this other part of his legacy, but it's very hard for me to narrate the shifts in thinking about peace and justice without relying on some things that he wrote. And then Jean-Paul Lederach, who's still living, the only person I've mentioned so far, we finally get to the living, who's still writing, and is teaching at Notre Dame University, and his books that I'm going to draw from is this one here. You know, if you have that in your library. You do have a library here, I'm assuming. And anyone know whether this book is in your library called Reconcile? The subtopic is Conflict Transformation for Ordinary Christians, and it's a book of stories, fascinating stories of the dynamics. John Paul is a good friend, he and I have done some teaching together. He's a sociologist, theologian combo. So fascinating writing. I want to draw on those two to work through this question of. Let's get back to Jesus, and let's try to reconstruct what it is that there may be there that we can embrace. The question of human agency, and by that I simply mean how do we see ourselves as actors in the bringing about of the vision that Jesus left us with, the kingdom of God, if you like. How are we involved? I mean, we talked about that in terms of the Anabaptists, the early Anabaptist tradition. Are we simply bystanders? Spectators? You know, like the hockey game is unfolding as it should, but we're just watching it? Not at all involved? No. I mean, and if we're involved, how are we involved? How do we understand that? There's a fair bit of discussion about that. And I think if we get more insight on that, it'll help us, at least it certainly has helped me, in terms of placing myself into the process of peace building, peacemaking. So I think about that. The question of eschatology, how do we see history moving? And then the question of the church, ecclesiology. Those are the questions and the topics that I want to pick up tomorrow evening and work with them. But let's open it up for discussion. We have 20 minutes or so. I promised that I would not keep you longer than 1.5 hours. So, yes. Yes.
You talk about the past tense. How do we justify that clearing of the temple by Jesus?
Yeah, that's always a question in any pacifist, New Testament pacifist emphasis book. People like Yoder and Lederach and Walter Wink, and all of them address it. And in Niebuhr, too. Not a single one of them will argue that that's a violation of Jesus' commitment to peace, to peacemaking. And why not? Because Jesus didn't kill anyone. And I think it is, however, a tension with a kind of a non-resistant reading of Jesus. Jesus clearly resisted what was going on in the temple. And he demonstrated that this is not this is not right. The temple is a house of prayer, and you have made it into whatever. And it's like, and therefore resisted it. And so I would couple that with a kind of a refinement of the non-resistant view of pacifism to a more resistant view of pacifism, but not a use of violence. To expel animals from the temple is not a violent act, not necessarily, at least. And so that's how, like, I don't know of us, well, there are some people who are not very careful, in my view, who will say, well, therefore Jesus wasn't a pacifist. I just don't think that that's a credible reading of what Jesus did in the temple. I mean, I do think that it is a form of resistance. Jesus resisted. Yeah.
Well, I look at it more as this human side, which justifies all of us in our own way. And I don't know how is God's side can be reconciled with that.
Well, it might even be, like, there's a lot of stories about God acting violently, and so it's much more easily to decide, to justify it on that side. So that might be even a harder question for the pacifist. But anyway, peacemaking, justice making, justice building is a struggle, and I think we are all drawn into that struggle of resistance. We don't, and Jesus was not one to avoid being drawn in deeply into conflictual situations. And so there was a form of resistance there. I mean, he confronted, particularly the religious leaders, used some pretty scathing language, like scoundrels, and compared them to some fairly, you know, low people in society, and upheld some of the other low people in society. So Jesus was very, in many ways, quite confrontational, but not violent. I mean, and you could see rather quickly how we get into questions of what we mean by words. Like, what does it mean to be violent? It's not a simplistic kind of an understanding if we want to be more careful about this. It's the kind of thing I get involved in classroom discussion, either here or in other contexts all the time. But thanks. Anyone else, comments or questions or challenges or resistance to what I have brought you? That's okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? May I push it back? Yes. Right. I mean, I do think it's like Guy F. Hershberger, whom I quoted, who didn't think Gandhi was operating on a kind of a Christian model, would, I think, say the same thing with respect to Martin Luther King. Although Martin Luther King comes later, so there's no opportunity to comment. I think King is a brilliant example of the power of nonviolent direct action, which he got from his understanding of who Jesus was. And I think he's right. And you know, one of the most fascinating things that I find about the Martin Luther King movement is how he was able to mobilize his people who were not historically pacifists. That wasn't them. How he was able to convince them and more or less, not entirely, keep them from violent engagement with some very violent responses that the police and other authorities exerted on them. How he was able to do that. And I to this day marvel at that. But there was an enormous kind of moral force, spiritual force, I don't know what it was. And nevertheless, force. I'm talking about force here, but not violence, that he used on his people in order to train them in nonviolence. And nonviolent training, that's another whole topic that I think is terribly crucial in our society. You know, with the loss of people like King and others, well, of course, that had a very specific focus, but I'm often amazed at how little our society is involved in nonviolence training and how important that is. In the North American universities and colleges and seminaries, there's a fair bit of emphasis, actually, on peace studies and centers for nonviolence compared to, say, even 50 years ago, there was hardly any department of those in the universities. But you have someone like Martin Luther King who was able to do that with the help of the media. I mean, it was very powerful. He used it very effectively. But nevertheless, and yes, so I think of the Martin Luther King movement as a Christian movement. I don't know. Does that, do you want to respond? Good. Okay. I gave the right answer? No. I had the wonderful opportunity of participating in one Martin Luther King rally in Chicago. I happened to be there for meetings, and this thing was going on, and of course I shut the city down. And I got drawn into it, and it was an absolutely amazing experience for me. Like the alternative power that existed with that group. That is, I say the alternative power, and that is that it's alternative to the authorities. Like there were police present. Now there was not a real confrontation, but normally we think of power as resting within, you know, weapons. And by the way, this is the thing that the military commander understood when he said, "You can't do this." Because I know how much power there is in nonviolence. It will make our guns ineffective. And that is, of course, the thing. If you're willing to die, I mean, the gun has the power of killing you. And if you take that power away by being willing to die, the gun loses its power. Now, it's simplistic, but I mean, in a sense, it's true. And so, you know, you see the movie from Montgomery to Memphis, I think it's called, the Martin Luther King movie. Is that the name of the movie? I think it is. There's this particular scene where the black people, I think, of Alabama want to be placed on the voters list to vote on the registry, and they line the steps to the court building or the legislative buildings. And there's this powerful scene of the police gets called in and they're dragged off one at a time and they're beaten, and as soon as one person is pulled off, another person takes that person's place. And the police they had no power. It was just grabbed away from them. And that's a kind of a classical confrontation of the power of nonviolence. Now, one needs to be a little careful with nuancing all of these things, but I mean, there is an enormous power there. And maybe that too can be abused. I'm not going to go there further for now. But all power, forms of power, can be abused. Okay, any other comment? Mm-hmm. Pacifism, okay. Yeah. Can you say a little more about what you mean that they would not have survived? I mean, they survived because they were not pacifist? Okay. Oh, yeah, confrontation is different than killing people. Yeah. Okay. I mean, right. Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of good friends who have gone through that experience. I even have some friends who chose to be part of the military. Good number of them have sort of repented of that, but not everyone. But I mean, look, that's part of the dynamic here. Yeah, I mean, my I have to confess. I do not condemn anyone. I don't like even soldiers have a very hard time sort of condemning them in any way. But it has not ever convinced me to change my voice in terms of what I speak for. We have this discussion in Iran all the time because they refer to all their soldiers who die as martyrs because they fight for God. And so when you go into a village, drive into a village, the main road is just like on every light post, there are pictures of the martyrs from this particular village, which are celebrated every day. And so martyrology or martyr theology is very, very common and very much talked about in that part of the world. And of course Mennonites also have stories of martyrs, right? And so we have on occasion compared our theologies. Their theology of martyrdom and the Mennonite theology of martyrdom. And of course, in the classic tradition, the Mennonite theology of martyrdom is sort of the opposite of theirs, and that is there is death precisely because the people involved in the conflict refuse to kill and are killed by refusing to kill. Whereas in their theology, there's no refusal to kill. There's a desire to kill, but somebody else has overpowered them and killed them first. So there's a significant difference there. But I know this is far removed from the question, but I think what it is, how it is that we participate in our peace, in the peace of this world, has everything to do with how it is that we think we ought to die or we give our lives for that particular project. And there are all kinds of exceptions in this. I have people in my family who are part of the military. And most of the people in my family were conscientious objectors, but some were not. That's just a complex, yeah. Who? Paul, yes.
So I think there's an early example of divided.
After the conversion. Yes. Yes, I referenced that in the sermon this morning. I mean, I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or that just
I mean, if someone were to come into my home and want to do violence to us, I mean, I don't have a gun in my house because I'm a pacifist, so I would not be able to use that kind of violence. Would I resist? Of course I would resist. I would do everything in my capacity to protect my loved ones. Everything. But I have no capacity to kill. Well, I mean, I suppose I could use knives, I suppose, but that wouldn't even occur to me. You know, I've had these weird experiences. I was in Jerusalem one time when I went into a hotel. I was going to make some reservations for a group that was coming in. Went into the hotel in the front part, and I noticed there was a skirmish out there in the back part of the lobby. And you know, there's often that in that region of the world. It's a fairly physical society, and people get involved. And they were really going at it. Then all of a sudden, one of the guys that was the center of this skirmish came. He wanted to go through. I thought he was going through the exit door, but he was there, and the exit was here, and I was here. And so in order to go through the exit, he had to go right by me. And so I sort of moved aside. But rather than going through the exit, he came right up to me, and he stood this far in front of me with his hand up like this. And I kept thinking, well, you know, I have nothing to fear because I have nothing against him. We've never even met ever before, so there's nothing going on here. Like, why is he doing that? And then I looked up and I saw him with a knife. And I still think, you know, I'm sure glad that he's not mad at me. Okay, he could kill me, you know. And I think I greeted him in the standard Arabic greetings. And then he walked by and left. And then I started shaking, like what was this? And I started thinking about that. And, you know, if I had been trained in violent responses to danger, in that case, it could very well have cost me my life. Because, you know, he could very well have killed me, but I didn't. I was completely passive in that. Now, I'm not arguing that that would be the case in all situations. I'm not saying that there is this careful law, but I think to train yourself in violent responses to surprising situations is not necessarily the safest thing to do. And of course, there are many stories of people who have averted violence in those kinds of situations by offering people a meal, by whatever their response is. Now, there are also some people who have suffered and died. So there are, I mean, pacifism is not a rule or a law that always has the best outcome. I mean, look at who our Savior is. It is not that way. So, sure. Well, yeah. Well,
it's like the classic question, right? Like, what do you do? And you don't know what you're going to do if you're in that situation. But I was saying, after that, we're in my house. I can just leave my house, right? Like, and you don't know what this person wants in your house, but you don't have to stay in that situation, right?
Maybe not.
Actually, this was a few years ago. Jesus was still a baby, and there was a man I didn't know, like another black man. to help him, and so he was just so, like, shocked. And then I didn't think about it until after I had already done it, that, oh, maybe should I not have been going over to you? But anyway, like, I'm just saying, you didn't mean you don't know what you're going to do until you're...
No, but you don't know, and certainly not sometimes, but I know I have a thing right in the house, I don't
life is complicated, and yes.
And I'm not sure that I'm making the right decision.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I'll get you. Everyone's had all the time.
Well,
have you
said
so nice to
you? Yeah, well, my father went through the revolution and came over in 1923 or 4. Many stories to tell. Of course, he survived all of them, as did his parents. I mean, those that didn't survive weren't here to tell the stories. So, but that was also the case. So, okay, we have reached the time of 3:30. Thank you very much for, you know, braving the weather and coming here. And I hope your vehicles all start and you have a good evening. It's getting warmer, by the way. So tomorrow night, balmy, what, 22 degrees or something like that? So, yeah. Thank you very much for your engagement in this, and we'll see you again tomorrow at 7, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, 7 o'clock tomorrow.
Thank you.
You're, yeah.